Welcome back. This is Mark Steiner, and we are going to tackle a very touchy, hard, painful subject, which was the killings that happened the last few weeks here in Baltimore, took the lives of young people. Michael Mayfield was only 17 years old. Rayshard Sinclair was 18, stabbed to death. And a young 14-year-old Najee Thomas was shot in his own home. They still don't know who did that killing. I think no one's been arrested for any of these killings yet that have taken place. Took three of our young lives in the city. We are joined in the studio by Michael Johnson, Executive Director of the Paul Robeson Institute for Social Change. Good to see you once again, my friend Michael.
Thank you.
Imhotep Fatihu is with us. He is Supervisor of the Outreach Workers and Violence Interrupters of the Safe Streets Park Heights and Executive Director of Urban Youth Initiative Project. Good to have you in the studio, Imhotep. Welcome.
Good morning.
Good to meet you. Dara Calhoun is in the studio. She's a school psychologist at Edmondson Westside High School and coordinator of the Edmondson Westside Peer Mediation Program that Michael Mayfield was part of.
Yes. Good morning.
Thank you for being with us today, and thank you for sending the music. We're going to play later, which was a dedication from the students to him that were composed that we will play for you all to hear. Dr. Catherine Bradshaw joins us. She is a professor, deputy director of the Johns Hopkins Center for the Prevention of Youth Violence and co-director of the Johns Hopkins Center for Prevention and Early Intervention. And Dr. Catherine Bradshaw, welcome. Good to have you with us as well.
Thank you very much.
And you all can join us here at 410-319-8888. Write to us here at steinershow@gmail.com. Log on to our Facebook pages. Tweet me at Mark Steiner. We do want to hear from you, 410-319-8888, as we kind of wrestle with these issues in a number of levels. The immediacy of the problem, what you do about the immediacy of the issue of violence in our communities and young people, and also the broader, deeper social issues that underlie this, that are creating this violence, this milieu of violence in our country. So 410-319-8888. But let me start with you, Dr. Bradshaw, since you're on the phone and get you to join, lead us off. And I just, you know, it always, this sense of violence and fear seems to permeate the air around us a lot, in not just the city but in the society. But it takes often this kind of killings of three young people in our community to make us kind of wake up again. And then we'll wake up for a while and we'll go back to sleep. But I wonder, just as you ponder this, given all the work you've done on youth violence, what this has said to you and what it made you start thinking about.
Well, obviously, our hearts and our thoughts and prayers go out to the families
right.
and friends who have lost loved ones, and there's nothing, no words that we can share that will make up for that. I think as we consider the life that they've lived and the pattern that they've left behind, we can really begin to think about a teachable moment here. Are there things that we can learn from the challenges that they faced or the lost opportunities that occurred for these youth that we can really try to have more of a prevention orientation? My work focuses largely in the schools, trying to address these issues when they start early on in a developmental pattern before they really bubble up to be more serious violence. It's great to have some of our collaborators on that are doing work also in the Park Heights area. We have some really innovative programming that's going on through our Youth Violence Prevention Center focused in the Park Heights area that connects up with the Safe Streets work there. So I think these are examples of some of the innovative work that we're trying to bring on to address these issues early and try to stem this problem before it escalates to be a more serious form of violence.
You know, I wonder, you know, in all the work you've done, Imhotep, in Safe Streets from the east side now back to your home place of Park Heights, when you look at murders like this, it's hard to say what could have intervened in any of these. I mean, one clearly was in the midst of some kind of struggle between a group of young men. The other two, just nobody even knows what happened and how you even begin to put your hands around that. I mean, so when you think about this in your work, I mean, some things you can intervene in, some things you can't. To talk a bit about what your response would be.
Well, we often talk a bit about norms about violence, and that sadly in some communities, violence has become the norm. It's been expected, and that youth walk around expecting to get into a fight, and if somebody gets in their face, they think it's okay to hit back or to use violence as a way of resolving conflict. So I think you address some of the societal issues, and we certainly see those issues around norms related to violence clustering in certain communities because of the history and the challenges that they've had around disparities and other social ills.
Imhotep?
Yes. When I heard and think of it,
I like to link it to the larger society. And what I understand about the society in which we live in is a fact of violent society, but we don't speak about that. So we like to isolate those acts of violence that catches our attention because it becomes popular. But the way I approach violence and the people that I work with is I make them aware of the larger scheme. A simple conversation, because I don't approach violence from a theoretical position. I'm a child of violence. I was shot. I was paralyzed. I spent 14 years in prison. I hurt people. I've been hurt. I was tortured in prison. So I understand violence at its core. And violence is produced from a number of things. First and foremost, when you don't have any love and respect for yourself, you don't have any love and respect for anyone else. So to begin to cure the violence, I got to be able to change the way people think and how they see themselves. But the way that is done is by making them realize that what you lack is due to a larger thing. And I think for most African-American people primarily, I think it's a lack of the history and the culture. It comes from them not really knowing who they are historically. They don't tie into anything. So when you can begin to take a people and tie them back into something important and link them to it, they can begin to view themselves as being important. Then they're less inclined to harm that which looks like them. That's my approach.
That's interesting. I want to probe this a little deeper in a moment and what you were just talking about. And I'm just going to take this in a kind of a bit of a jumble here to get these different thoughts out on the table, and then I'm kind of pull them back in with some things that both of you have already been talking about.
Okay.
But Dara, I want you. I mean, you work with kids every day in school.
Yes.
As a psychologist.
Yes.
Right.
Yes.
And you knew young Michael Mayfield.
I knew Michael Mayfield very well. He was one of my closest students, and I've known him since he started, and he introduced himself to me. He was not a student that was on my caseload, but kind of came to me because of his desire to help others. So he was trained and became a peer mediator, the program that I helped to coordinate. And never had to ask Michael to do anything. He always came forward and offered and wanted to help others. And his main focus was, how can we resolve this situation peacefully? That's the question he would ask when he would walk into a room before a mediation.
It just must have been so crushing for all of you when that happened, given who he was, and maybe people think that his murder was murder by accident, that people looked at him as somebody else and killed him, is one of the theories being floated around at the moment. But
sad.
It really is. I mean, you see a young man kind of pulling himself up. And you know, and Michael, let me bring you in here. I mean, you've been involved in community activism.
Forever. You know, I think that Brother Hotep said it pretty much. What we repeat is that, you know, violence has to do with a lot of bigger issues. But we have a tendency, as you had mentioned earlier, to wait until there's this massive amount of repeat violence and not looking at the big picture. And when the young lady, and I'm sorry, I forgot your name.
Dar
had mentioned about, you know, the peer mediation that's going on. I mean, these are things that need to be going on from the time a child hits kindergarten. Because at a certain point, you can almost see the types of children that are going to maybe fall into a problem. But the community waits every time. I mean, this will be here 2 weeks from now. It'll be quiet. There was a comment that a young student said to me up in Northwestern. He said to me, he says, well, why was his funeral more important than another funeral? When every funeral should be important. Every funeral, if you got the mayor, if you got the congressperson, if you got the senator, everybody should be at that funeral, because what it does is it brings the attention. Because no child is no better than any child, especially when they're killed. But we do live in a violent society. We're talking about wars. We're talking about wars overseas. We used to, and Mark and I, we grew up as peace people who didn't want any type of war. Now we accept war as an answer. And I did like the fact that the president made a comment, and I know this is off the page a little bit, made a comment that, you know, America shouldn't be preparing for war anymore. Well, we shouldn't be preparing for violence anymore in our communities as well.
Well, let me just raise, there are two issues here I want to kind of deal with. I mean, maybe you all won't agree completely with this supposition, but I'll throw it out here anyway. I mean, on the one hand, I want to talk about the larger issues that bring violence into our world. But then knowing you can't always put your hands around that immediately, what do we do to work with young people in our communities to kind of change, help them change their own lives and address. I mean, I was thinking what your story was, Imhotep, and what you just said. And there's a line I've used in the show for the last 15, 16 years, and I think it's very powerful. And people like you are very important in our community, I think, because to me, there's nothing more powerful than the thug who has turned to peace. And I think that says a lot about the kind of energy that can flow in and out that we can talk about. But, I mean, when you look at stats in America, let me just throw out two things here just to wrestle with for a moment. This is about women. One in five women have been raped or has experienced attempted rape in the society. And that's the conservative estimate. One in six women have been stalked. One in four have been beaten up by their intimate partner. And when A.O. Scott, the great film critic, was talking about violence in society and film, he said that this visibility of violence in Hollywood is just overwhelming, that we depict it and we celebrate it and it becomes part of the crazed nuance of what some people call the casino capitalism we live under that loves violence and puts it all around us, and wrote, "A society defined by brutal masculine authority, the pathology of which infects the family, the economy, and the state," is what he said as he looks at these films that are coming out of Hollywood now, that Scott wrote in a piece about a year ago. So, I mean, how do you think that affects where we are? And, I mean, so you all wrestling with doing things on the immediate level, you know, especially three of you in this, so on the immediate level every day working with young people, but this larger piece pervades it all. How do you think that affects it all and affects our young people?
Well, I can speak particularly when you speak of the young women. It has a lot to do, and actually with all young people, male and female, with just this self-image and a sense of self-worth, kind of piggybacking on what Imhotep had mentioned about, understanding, our history and our culture. And it just has come to a point where self-image and self-worth is low. And a lot of it starts with just communication and conversations, and that's what I use. That's how I deliver service in our school, and that's what I encourage among the students, just to talk to each other. If you see someone in the hallway who appears sad, angry, or upset, ask them what's wrong. You know, how are you doing? Can I bring you to someone you can talk to? Just open up the door of communication. And again, that's how Michael was. And you'd be surprised just by opening your mouth and talking or asking a question, you know, what you can find out or how you can change, you know, the outcome of a situation. And it's interesting, I don't know if I'm going off subject, but during one of the initial news reports of Michael's murder, a member of his family made the comment, if this individual who shot Michael would have just spoken to him, asked him, who are you, maybe Michael would still be here today. So it's as simple as that in my mind, just to communicate, to talk to each other. If you see something, if you hear something, ask a question, let somebody know.
I think one of the things, in addition to that, that we're talking about, you know, is imagery. I mean, the imagery starts, I mean, you know, I heard somebody on the radio one time say that, you know, I'm sometimes tired of hearing about old stories. Well, you know, sometimes old stories worked. And so now we're dealing with a media that has almost 188 channels, if not 900 and something channels. We're dealing with music played on the radio that glorifies. You've got artists who have put their hands on women who haven't been, at least I don't think they've been satisfied with justice. We have the imagery of women are now being dressed and looked, and you have Time Magazine, who puts a very smart businesswoman on the front cover, but puts her on the front cover almost butt naked. So when you look at all of the imagery and all of the things that are being flooded in, and then we're not talking about something that just happened last week. This is the third generation of the miseducation of adults, a miseducation of parents of a lot of these young people. So when we're looking at the bigger picture, we have to look at is what has the media produced, what have we allowed the media produce, and what are we responding to the media?
I do want to get Catherine, I want you to jump into this, but we have to take a very short break and come back, and I really want to get your thoughts and then lead into what we need to do is if we understand the underpinnings. We're going to go out with a piece of a song by Rebel called The Good Die Young that was written for Michael. And we will try to get the whole song played before the end of the hour if we can.
It's just like, you know, you see this kind of stuff on movies and sometimes on TV, but when it knocks at your front door, it's really painful.
Hard to write when your heart hurting. You pray for peace, but it's uncertain when you gon' leave. Death lurking in the shadows. See the devil's working. Still play it safe and still he got murk, man. Whatever kind of person it takes to take that angel away before his promise big break. Who would've thought his borrowed time was quicker than we could take? Who would've thought a head wound would take him out of his place instead of a scholarship up on a mound or a base? I mean, really though, I just think it's silly though. I ain't even get close enough to see identity though. Would've knew it was Mike, you would've let him go. Instead of making this song, he let the trigger go. Damn, little did he know he had a girl and a fam. ROTC sportsman with a plan. Now you got me looking at the world like, damn, help me understand, I'm saying.
What a good die young, what a good die young. Seems it's always the case. In the hood where I'm from, in the hood where I'm from. It ain't always safe. It's like you gotta keep a gun. Why you gotta keep a gun? I need out of this place. What a good die young. 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 Seems it's always the case. In the hood where I'm from. In the hood where I'm from. It ain't always safe. It's like you gotta keep a gun. Why you gotta keep a gun? I need out of this place. What a good die young. What a good die young. What a good die young.
And I wish that I could keep with you. Cut class in the cafeteria and eat with you. I mean, you was a good kid, but we all human. And E-Dub 14, man, we all stupid. Look back, ninth grade in the hallways. You saying better get to class. I'm like, not today. Said it's gonna bite me in the ass in the wrong way. And the energy I fed off it. Years later, see you in the mayor's office. How we get you back? You never hold the strap. Unless we're talking about that gun when you pitch a scrap. We all seen D1 in your picture. Fact, and now we only get to see you in the picture. That really hurts me. Dog, it really hurts me. I got up on my knees, pray the Lord down, murk me. Keep your family in my prayers. Looking at the world like, damn, help me understand. I'm saying,
what a good die young, what a good die young. Seems it's always the case. In the hood where I'm from, in the hood where I'm from. It ain't always safe. It's like you gotta keep a gun. Why you gotta keep a gun? I need out of this place. What a good die young, what a good die young. 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 Seems it's always the case. In the hood where I'm from. In the hood where I'm from. It ain't always safe. It's like you gotta keep a gun. Why you gotta keep a gun? I need out of this place. What a good die young. What a good die young.
What a good die young.
I just wish I had one more opportunity to just have dinner with them. And I just want to say to everyone, you never know when it's going to be your last time that you'll lay your eyes on a person.
A 17-year-old on his way to graduation, a member of JROTC, a pitcher on his school's baseball team, and a band member killed last week.
Welcome back. And that's the conclusion of the piece that was written in his honor, in Michael Mayfield's honor, by a friend, Rebel. The Good Die Young. We are here with Michael Johnson, Executive Director of the Paul Robeson Institute, Imhotep Fatihu, who is a supervisor with Park Heights Safe Streets, and the Executive Director of Urban Youth Initiative Project, Derek Calhoun, school psychologist at Edmondson Westside, where Michael went, and Dr. Catherine Bradshaw, Deputy Director of the Johns Hopkins Center for Prevention of Youth Violence and the Hopkins Center for Prevention and Early Intervention. 410-319-8888. Please give us a call. We want to get to your calls coming in. We want to hear your ideas. But, Catherine, let me turn to you next and just kind of pick up where we left off. And just given the larger societal picture of who we are as a culture, what's happening to us here, and then how you think we begin to respond to that on a level of prevention, given the pervasiveness of the rest of it in our society.
Well, you were talking about the role of media in terms of violent images, either in music or film or videos, violent video games. We have a very large and growing body of research documenting the risks associated with consuming high rates of violent media. And so I have to think that that plays a role in contributing to the norms around violence within society. And certainly there's some individuals, particularly aggressive kids, that are more attractive to that type of material and really consume it at higher rates. But we do know, even from small-scale experimental studies where you get kids to play violent video games that are shoot and point kind of video games, we know that we can even increase their aggressive thoughts even in a relatively short period of time. So as we think about the level of violence and violent imagery that is available to us 24/7 through the internet and on TV, it's not surprising that our tolerance for violence has sadly increased as a society.
And, you know, I was thinking about in terms of how you approach that with your work, Imhotep. I mean, when you think about it, I mean, there is a pervasiveness of violence, and it goes to the games. It also goes to the way society is organized and what we do to care little about people's lives and their work and how they have to struggle to survive, and all that kind of lends itself to this aura. And so, and you're dealing every day with a world of people who are, in some respects, many of them, are the throwaways.
Yes.
Right?
Correct. The media, when I say the media, I don't disconnect the media from the system. I think the way people are educated in this society causes them to compartmentalize everything. And as long as we continue to compartmentalize, we're going to miss the mark. So we can say the media, but the media is still birthed within this society. It's structured in this society. It's reinforced in this society. This society allows the media to be as it is. So it doesn't allow the society to get off. So the problem on a larger scale is mass ignorance in terms of how human beings evolve and how we develop. On a more microscopic level, the problem becomes that we don't want to take the individuals who are the victims of society, because people have been victimized, and through victimization, we develop these survival mentalities. And because of this survival mentality and the environment we find ourselves in, those laws work. It's like, case in point, if we was landed in some wild jungle somewhere, we're going to be getting, and we can't find civilization, we'll start doing what we have to do to survive. We may eat some things that we normally wouldn't eat in that environment, but having given the opportunity to find ourselves back to civilization, we would change and adapt to civilization. So if you're taking people, young people, the ones that I deal with, they come out of an environment that kind of fosters that behavior. So how do we reverse that? That's my thing. The way I reverse it is taking these same young people and making them realize that they are more than what they do. You are more than what you do. It's hard to change that. It's easier for me because I can tell them I was you. And when I show them that I was them in what I'm doing today, they're more inclined to listen. I can say I know what it is to walk down the street and someone pick on you. I know what it is to walk down the street and see guns land on a thing. I understand that perfectly well. I know what it is to be in a school when the culture says that you have to defend yourself. I understand that perfectly well. But where did all that come from? Why are the males so violent? You know, because we live in a society that's patriarchal that says the man should be able to do whatever he want to do when he want to do it. Smack your woman, throw her out, do whatever, get away with it. You know, this is the society. It's in the media. The system perpetuates that, and it just comes on down. So now our children are what? They're the recipients of misinformation. And because they are young and their minds can't process it, we see the violence. The violence is a form of behavior. The violence is socialization. It's how they have been socialized. So we have to what? Reverse that socialization only through proper education. For African people, African-American people, they need to know exactly who they are, what they come from, what they have done, and they need to see that on a daily, constant basis. The healing for African people becomes a cultural renaissance within the African community.
Let's see what our listeners think. Unless you either want to jump in, we'll go right to the phones here, 410-319-8888. Let's go to Kay in Baltimore. You've been holding on a while.
Yeah, good morning.
Good morning.
The gentleman that just talked about the media, I applaud you. The media is a pain in the posterior end. I listen and I read some of the things that the media has to do, just like the percentage of black kids are hungry, black, stupid, and everything. Come on, let's get real. You don't need a PhD to realize that this is incorrect. I truly believe at a one-on-one relationship with anybody outside of your comfort zone makes a difference. There are black kids that think when white people are late with payments or something, They don't have to pay. They don't have to pay their gas and electric bill. They don't have to pay their car note. Anger comes from a lot of things that can really be resolved if we say to these kids, you know what, post their skin is white, honey. If they don't pay their gas and electric, it gets turned off. I'm an Army brat. I was the only child that went to Italy after the war. I have always been in an area, sometime the only black. But you know what? I was taught, Kay, to stand up. If somebody talks to you in a rude way, and it still happens, excuse me, I didn't talk to you like that. The anger can be curbed, but it doesn't take a PhD. It doesn't take a doctrine. Do these people that sit in this white tower, have you ever sat down with a black family and had dinner? Have you actually ever been in a church when there's a funeral? Some things, Mark, it's like common sense. Some things it's like, come into my home and see. Let me come into your home and see. How can you dislike me? You don't even know me. And this is really what gets to me. It doesn't take a PhD. It doesn't take a doctorate. You don't have to have 100 degrees on your wall to know that somebody's suffering. And the news media, oh, my God.
Kate, I appreciate your thoughts. It's very, very, very serious thinking there. So let's wrestle a bit with what you were saying about how this relates to our kind of, I was about to say war against violence, but let's try to find a different way of framing that as war, kind of our effort to stem the violence in our communities.
I think there was a comment made much earlier. You know, if we don't know who you are, you obviously don't know where you're going. And what we've done is that, especially in the education system, on a whole level of education system, is replaced who you are. It was very interesting to come up in the 60s and 70s, and you had more African-American study courses in high school than you actually have today. And they were being taught by very, very aggressive African-American professors instructors who had very good relationships with the white instructors who would always mix the culture. So I got to learn a little bit more about other folks. I think that what we have a tendency to do is that we will not admit that we have failed two to three generations right now. And that the thing that we're looking for is we're looking for midnight basketball instead of maybe midnight music classes or midnight history courses or midnight technology courses. Everybody's not a basketball player in the black community.
So, Catherine, let me ask you to jump in on this and we'll go back to Imhotep and go back to the phones.
Well, another thread that came out in the comments that were raised were about the importance of being connected to people. And while we actually have a very robust body of literature to show the importance of connectedness, and that can be connected to the school, to an adult at the school, to a parent at the home, or a good friend. And the importance of connectedness, it really goes back to the attachment literature and the importance of bonding, but feeling connected to others and that you're cared about and somebody can actually help you when you need that are really very basic concepts that are pervasive across, you know, human development, but we know are actually very robust protective factors when it comes to violence involvement.
And I think that you were about to say something, Imhotep, before we go to the phones again?
Yes. Dr. Amos Wilson was a profound and prolific writer and a profound African-American psychologist. He written several books. I think one of the favorite books that I like is Black on Black Violence. I would refer anyone to read that book. And within that book, through his research and his studies, he can clearly tie Black on Black violence to the larger society, because we want to keep on stepping around it. We want to keep on making all these studies and have all this literature. We need to start telling the truth and speaking the truth and talking the truth, right? We live in a violent society. The USA was built on violence. The land was taken from the people that was already here. You had slavery. You had all this stuff going on. You got all these wars that's being perpetrated and being organized and engineered. You know, you got the drugs that was pushed inside communities. The land that we living on is violent. It's a violent land, so we can't keep on trying to create these studies, right, that's separating the people from the society, and you're studying the people as if the people are the problem. The people are the recipients of a problematic society, and that's what we got
to
look at.
So while we try to change larger society, which has to be an effort we have to focus on,
yes.
The question is then what now, so that, well, we're in our own small community here of Baltimore, Maryland, mm-hmm. or the state of Maryland. And we can, so how do we begin to think creatively about how to address the immediate problem? You're not going to end it as long as we have the madness that affects our society as a whole and poverty and lack of employment. All that goes to the bottom line. But meanwhile, the work you do, MOTIP, is in, and other people are doing, Catherine's doing, is to, and you're doing in your school, is to try to ameliorate that, to be, change the culture of violence, to raise the consciousness of young people. So what does that investment take to really do it in a serious way in a community like ours?
You've got to hear, and I'm sorry, my brother, you've got to hear the voices of the people who are doing the work. You can't keep, you know, we're listening to Mark Steiner's show, we're hearing the people do stuff, but the people who are in the positions to do aren't hearing us.
So, Darrell, what were you about to say?
Well, I just, I like the idea of the just building the personal relationships, and I think as a culture we're conditioned not to talk to each other. And what we're doing at Edmondson, we're in our first year of a peer mediation program, and I'm sure there were a number of people when we introduced it and mentioned, oh, this just, is just another intervention that's kind of going to come and go. But surprisingly, I had trained a wonderful group of kids, including Michael Mayfield, who was at the helm, and I want to say 9 out of 10 of the referred mediations were resolved peacefully. I mean, and these were situations where these children were about to, they were faced, you know, some situations they're face to face, ready to, you know, resolve the problem like the only way they know, with their fists. And when either an adult or another student stepped in and said, hey, would you be willing to come in here and sit down and talk about it? 9 out of 10 of them agreed to it. And the conflict was resolved simply with the question, you know, how can we resolve this peacefully? You give each of them a chance to, and they're speaking to each other for the first time, and that's what's amazing. And they would walk out of the room not necessarily being friends, but understanding where, you know, this other person is coming from, and helping to helping to establish a respect.
So peer mediation works.
It does work.
So Imhotep, then Catherine, then we're going to go to the phones.
Yes, I think the peer mediation is excellent, and it's going to always work when we involve the youth. One of the angles I hit it from is that I like the, because we can't not tackle the larger society, like you said, so you got to work at the immediate little areas in the world where you find yourself at. But the way we can begin to knock it off is that I still think the children should know the truth. So whatever intervention that we utilize to meet our immediate need with the children, they still should know the truth in terms of what's really going on. So as they become adults, we can begin to build this movement to really tackle the larger society, because the larger society has to be tackled. But we're never going to tackle it if we don't want to talk about the larger society, what this larger society is doing. The children, the youth, need to know the truth. African-American children primarily need to know who they are. We need to push the African culture as much as we can. That is the thing that saved me, and that's the thing that saved the children that I work with. I work with children in Utah Marshall Elementary School, Falls Park High School, and with my own organization, the Urban Youth Initiative Project. And all the children that we work with, we have successful outcomes in changing their mentality and their behavior.
Catherine?
We have been doing work in Park Heights as well as in the Cherry Hill area with a model called Coping Power that includes programming for youth as well as for parents that help kids learn to recognize when they're getting upset and identify other alternative or pro-social strategies that they can use to resolve interpersonal conflict. So it pulls in some themes around conflict resolution because we give kids opportunities to practice resolving problems that occur in the school setting. And one of the challenges we have with these models, although they've been shown to be highly effective, is getting parents to come in and engage with the programs. We can offer support, daycare, other kind of resources, but getting parents to come into the schools is a real challenge. In many cases, the parents had bad experiences in schools, and so getting them to come in to help out with their own kids is often a little bit of a challenge for them.
Let me go back to the phones here and bring you all right back in. 410-319-8888. Try to get a couple more callers in here. Barry, you're on the air.
Hello, good morning.
Good morning.
I by chance happen to be a mediator. I'm a parent educator for parents going through divorce. And as you're identifying this thing about information for children, the one thing that we forget is children spell love, T-I-M-E. I don't care what information you give them. If you don't spend the time with them, they're not going to get it. Stephen Biko identified that the greatest weapon of the oppressor is the mind of the oppressed. And unfortunately, in the black community, we've been hoodwinked, bamboozled into believing certain things have value that have no value. For example, with sports, there are 1,000 696 football players mm-hmm. in a given season. There are 450 basketball players in a given season. If you go to the FBI statistics on homicide for America, in a low year, that's 12,000 homicides, of which all too often 50% are persons of color. That's one of the bits of information that's hidden from people because we only look at it at the city level. That's 6,000 black people or persons of color killed. And then you, let's hope those are not done by serial killers. That's 6,000 murderers. And I believe it comes from the lack of attention that we give to our children, the lack of attention that we give to one another. We fail to see one another, and consequently, in our technologically distracted world, think about it. Right. When a parent is on a cell phone with a kid, and if love is spelled T-I-M-E, well, you're looking at your cell phone during the time you're with me, so I must be equal to a web page. How does that help you to feel? So my issue is it's about attentiveness and our failure to really see what's important. 450 basketball players, or if you're about a particular team,
right.
watching 15 men, what they do when in your city 300 kids are being killed, something's wrong about that.
Barry, I'm glad you joined us. Thank you so much for those thoughts.
And that goes, what we're saying is, I'm sorry, Mark, if you want to go to the phone.
I just really, we hear that, and I still want to come to the point of, you know, when we hear people in government now say that we want to wrestle this, we want mm-hmm. to challenge this, we care about our children, we want to end the violence, mm-hmm. but we see that the rec centers are closing, there's not money for violence mm-hmm. intervention. That is like a back burner issue in public health programs, not a front, not mm-hmm. an issue that's in the front. And whether some people would need to argue about where money goes in the budget, does it go to police, does it go to people who are organizers and therapists and peacemakers? Mm-hmm. Something I think we really do. I mean, people think, oh, Mark, you're crazy. You say you can't talk about no more money for the police, not extra money for the police, putting that money into peacemakers. But maybe we do have to think about a reorientation of what we do, you know, about who's in our communities. That's what I'm saying. I mean,
they used to be called peace officers. So,
So the question is, I wonder how we think about what we would say about what we have to do that way in our community about where the efforts have to be. And you're talking to the mayor, mm-hmm. you're talking to the city council, what has to be said?
Well, I think that you made the comment when you were talking about Perrin Mitchell, you're talking about someone who was about the people. So the first thing, he was close enough to the people that could understand it. The problem that we have is that it is impossible for anyone to imagine that there's something wrong with the child. There's something wrong with adults. There's something wrong with adults when you sit around and, like you said, you give all of this money for developers and all of these money for the police department and all of these monies for this and that. And then you give absolutely no money and you want to know what's the problem mm-hmm. with young people. Mm-hmm. And then we sit around and we say we cut the rec centers. Well, it's not like, okay, if we cut the rec centers, are you adding more music? Are you adding more technology? Are you adding more historical perspective so a young person can train? There's nothing wrong with the young people. There's something, and we need a Marshall Plan. And I've said this 1,000 times, where we sit down and not just listen to the young people, but we look at the budget and the way that the monies are being spent and allocated and say, is this really the good way that this should go?
I think the people that run governments are anti-children. Dr. Amy Wilson teaches us that the best way to understand the psychology of any person is to understand the history of the person. So society is nothing but a projection of the psychology of those that run society. And looking at the history of the world, the primary individuals that run society are anti-children. This society is not trying to build children to perpetuate this society. This society is trying to figure out how to make more money for individuals.
So on the way to the phones here, Catherine, do you want to jump in on this at all? And Darren, then we get back to the phone to at least get one more caller in here.
Yeah, I want to say, I mean, at Edmondson, the focus is students first. Our principal, Carl Perry, he's really big on that. He will ask no questions, whatever monies are needed to fund whatever project that's going to benefit the students first, he's all for. And I believe that's part of the reason why we've been so successful, because and the students feel that the time that the caller spoke of is so important. You know, when our administrators and our teachers are out in the hallways and we're having conversations and just greeting the students, it makes such a difference. And I just want to say, just it helps foster some of the natural leadership qualities that a lot of our young people have within them. And as a result of this tragedy that we've experienced at Edmondson, we've been moved to launch a Michael Mayfield project because his spirit, you know, continues within us. And it's really aimed to be a leadership development program to cease violence in the schools, teach conflict resolution. This is something that has to be taught, which means time and resources have to be given within schools to teach conflict resolution, especially with the younger children, and also to encourage the members of the community, parents, families, to be involved in their children's lives, to look out the windows, you know, talk to each other, call in for help, you know, when you see or observe something, and just for everybody to open books, learn about our history and our rich culture, and put down the weapons and just, you know.
And I think it says a lot about your principal that you even have a full-time psychologist on in the school, which happens very rarely in our schools.
And we're lucky at Northwestern that Dr. Simmons does the same thing.
He does.
Yes.
We have to go back to Northwestern another day. But Catherine, your thoughts on this before we open the phones? One last thought.
I was just thinking, you know, want to echo the previous statement about the importance of the connections between youth and adults and the principals that really put themselves out there to have more of a prevention orientation, adopting programs like conflict resolution. There are other models we work with around school-wide positive behavior support that really help to provide constructive roles for kids and strategies and techniques and training so that way they can learn to resolve problems before they escalate. I think it's critical that we continue to have the resources and find resources in different ways and work collaboratively. Quite often we're trying to apply for federal grants and need schools to partner with. We just got a whole new grant funded to be able to use this coping power model and would love to partner with some middle schools in the area to be able to expand it more broadly.
Let me try to get on the call in here before we run out of time at 410-319-8888. Mike on line 4, you're on the air.
Can you hear me?
Yes.
Okay, yeah, you know, I think there's a caller, lady, she sounded like an elder, and I'm just blown away by Imhotep's wisdom. You know, and I think what we need to do to signal across the gap, yeah, we got to talk about, you know, the personal responsibility piece, but when systems, you know, Hopkins and all those that Catherine represents, what they need to do if they want to get involvement from folks that are hard to reach is that they need to come starting with the premise that systems are trifling, right? Because we always talk about how do we amend the behavior of people or parents or principals, right? But the systems themselves are challenged, as Imhotep has said. So if you signal that as a person with that gatekeeping power, you're willing to talk about the system, people hear you differently. And so that's the primary thing that never or that rarely happens when we have these discussions, is that those with the most power, with the ability to get the biggest grants and all that, because as many of the folks have said, we know what works. And what it boils down to is putting humanity back and love back into the conversation. And sometimes that gets parsed out with the technicalities of grant writing. But if we bring that spirit in the room by being willing to signal our own shortcomings, then I think we have a different conversation. So that's what we do, you know, both at Equity Matters and Place Matters, but also with all the partnerships we've had, including the successful ones we've run with Hopkins when we were in that Garrison and took kids to campus and showed them people that looked like them that had been to school. We had enormous outcomes. But the real thing that was there was love and the willingness to talk about the failure of the system, and we rarely do that.
Well, I think that's why we raise the issues. That's why I raise the issues I raise around that, because I think we have to think of a double-pronged approach. I was thinking about Mark Herskard, who was on the show a little bit ago, talking about the environment. When he was talking about we have to stop pulling oil out of the ground and stop taking minerals out of the ground. We have to make a mass movement to stop what's going on, but we also have to learn how to adapt or we're not going to survive. So it's both. It's saving the children we can save and creating programs that address the issue of violence and changing the consciousness of our young people and building that while a larger struggle goes on about the systemic forces that dominate society. They go together.
Yes.
And
yes.
I think Imhotep kind of was eloquent in putting that on the table here during the course of our conversation. And I want to thank all of you. It was great to meet you. Imhotep Fatou, it was wonderful to meet you. Good to have you
thank
here.
You. Likewise.
Who runs Safe Streets in Park Heights and is also Executive Director of Urban Youth Initiative Project. Great to meet you, Dara Calhoun. school psychologist at Edmondson Westside High School and coordinates their peer mediation program and was working with and very close to Michael Mayfield, one of the young people who killed in our community. Good to have you in the studio.
Thanks for having me.
Good to see you, my dear friend Michael Johnson, who's resurrected the Paul Robeson Institute for Social Change.
Yes.
As I'm making a big go of it, good to have you in the studio.
Yeah, thank you, Mark.
And Dr. Catherine Bradshaw, who is co-director of the Johns Hopkins Center for the Prevention and Early Intervention and deputy director of their Center for the Prevention of Youth Violence. Always good to have you on the show, Catherine. Thank you so much for taking the time.
Thank you all for attending to this important issue.
We are going to take a brief break and come back with our weekly edition of Sound Bites, looking at the future of the food in our farm system. We're going to go out with Mood Indigo, Duke Ellington, of course, born on this day in 1899. Stay with us. We'll be right back.